The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
I help people every day to improve their health. Sometimes they've had lifelong issues or not fully recovered after a stressful event. The doctors have often run out of ideas. My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session. For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
Hello, I'm Robin Daly, and this is the Yes to Life show, a show that investigates every aspect of integrative medicine for cancer. My guest on the show today is Dr. Sam Watts, a cancer researcher and now an Ayurvedic practitioner, who is passionate about integration for all types of disease prevention and control, but particularly when it comes to cancer. I'm speaking to Dr. Watts over the phone at his practice in East Wittering on the south coast of Sussex. Sam, there's a few strokes of fate got in the way of making this call, but perseverance has won the day.
It has, we're here, and that's the main thing, so
yeah,
that's all good.
Really looking forward to this. So look, I'd pulled together a great selection of things to talk to you about, but I started my day today by watching one of your videos, The Mindset of Exceptional Cancer Survivorship. And it was so much completely on message with Yes to Life and what we're doing in the charity that I thought, right, we're starting to talk about that, because you expressed very eloquently the reasoning behind so much of what we do at Yes to Life. So do you want to just start off by telling us something about hope, empowerment, the exceptional mindset that you spoke about in this video? Because I think this is just like the heart of the matter.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, for me, you know, if you look at the cancer survivorship work, you know, I'm sure obviously it's part of what you do and everything, but it's changed, I think, trajectory quite significantly probably in the last 10 years. In you know, 8 to 10 years ago, it was trying to tease apart the specifics, wasn't it? You know, what way can diet impact upon cancer biology or meditation? And those things are, you know, mandatory, I suppose, in survivorship, but I think it missed the core issue as such, which is the person behind those behaviours that seems to make the biggest difference. And I'm utterly convinced, and I suppose there is research to support this as well, that it's the mindset that the patient cultivates or tries to build that allows cancer patients to do incredibly well. And I think, you know, if you're looking at this idea of particularly more so when people are facing bad news, and I guess the prognosis isn't as good as people would have liked or was hoping for, the way that the person responds to that and deals with that, I think, has a profound effect upon the trajectory of the illness and quality of life, and arguably quantity of life over that period onwards. And I think when someone responds to that kind of bombshell about cancer being diagnosed or it progressing or whatever it may be, I think the natural response to that is all the very damaging emotions like fear and uncertainty, and that's natural. But I think when cancer patients are able to go into themselves and say, you know, I acknowledge all this, and you know, this is the statistics, and this is what I'm being told, but you know, I choose a different reality, and that reality is that I'm going to put myself at the very, very centre of my recovery. I'm going to take the very best of conventional medicine. I'm going to take the very best of integrative and complementary medicine, and I'm going to, you know, do everything that's in my power to give myself, you know, the longest life possible with the highest quality of life possible. And I think there's such strong research, I think, to support how that mindset changes us biochemically. You know, there's work showing how, you know, when we mobilize those kinds of traits and those kinds of emotions, how it changes immunity, it reduces inflammation, it changes the chemical pathways in the body. It has a profound effect upon, we can have a profound effect upon the way our body mobilizes as a defense against not just cancer, but most chronic conditions. So, you know, I just think it's a thing. I just think it's such a massive issue. I don't think it's tapped into or mobilised enough. I think it could be. I think it could be taught a lot better. We know people can learn these skills. So I just think it's everything.
Right.
I think it's so important.
Okay. Well, I'm right with you on everything you said. I think, you know, even if you ignore all that huge swathe, as you said, of evidence that shows that actually your mindset affects biochemically, physically, you know, the way that your body responds, even you just take a simple factor of like, well, if you're in a hopeless mindset, what are the chances you're going to make a good decision about recovering your own health? You know, they're not very high, are they?
Yes. And,
you know, you're not in the right
they're
place.
Very, very low. And I think one of the things that I found so fascinating years ago, I went through a phase of getting quite heavily involved with reading lots of the published and unpublished Holocaust transcripts.
Okay.
And one of the things that absolutely jumped out at me was the commonality and similarity from the people, you know, that got out of those camps and the mindset that they employed.
Hmm.
And some of the case study accounts of the exceptional cancer patients, particularly those with, you know, terminal prognosis who then go on to 5-10 years survival, it was like they were almost identical. And it really hit me that, you know, this idea of hope, you know, if we have hope, we have everything, don't we? If we have hope, then there's always the opportunity for things to go well. But I think as soon as we lose hope, you know, as soon as we lose hope, everything goes with it. Our quality of life, our physical function, our vitality, our motivations, our relationships, everything goes with that. And I think, you know, I think you're right. I mean, hope is probably the single most important flame to keep alight when things are going wrong in any context, but particularly, you know, in the cancer arena. And like I said, also things around the decision-making and making the right calls about whether I had this treatment or that treatment. If we're in a fight-or-flight response and we're being very reactive, then we're not able to make good decisions. Where if we're a little bit more balanced and calm, we're able to make decisions and, you know, weigh things up and say, no, this is the best course for me, this is the best option for me. So, yeah, I think it's all-consuming. I think it affects every facet and every variable of cancer survivorship. Mm. Yeah, it's so important.
So basically, that kind of puts hopelessness at the top of the danger list of, you know, risks to your health. Hopelessness might be one of the most important ones.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm convinced of it. And I think, and I'm sure anyone, you know, who works with people who are seriously ill, I'm sure, you know, everyone would have seen patients who have a similar diagnosis and prognosis, and the trajectory they follow from that point on is fundamentally different, in that one will you know, their quality and quantity of life will be significantly impaired, and the others go on to long-term healthy, you know, survivorship. And I think there are so many things that impact upon that, but it is, one of the biggest common answers I've seen is just that, it's the way they approach it, and the idea of, you know, just refusing to let hopelessness and fear and disempowerment become, you know, the primary emotions, and just doing things that help people become motivated and hopeful. And it hasn't always got to be, you know, very manualized interventions, just things that make us feel good, you know, spending time with family and friends, doing hobbies. This concept of ikigai, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard about, this Japanese concept of, you know, why I get up in the morning. You know, it's huge in the longevity research at the moment. There's very clear research showing that people who have this concept of ikigai, people who have a reason for getting up in the morning, who have meaning and purpose in their life, they statistically have better health profiles, and they typically live longer. And I think, you know, when we have an illness, if we have that reason for wanting to live rather than not wanting to die, it's a subtle but very, very profound difference. And I think it's hard to have that if we're feeling helpless and hopeless. So yeah, I would put it right at the top of the list, actually.
Well, I think I would too. And you just spoke there about this is something you can teach to people. That's an interesting concept, because it's not thought about in that way generally. And I've tended to think of it about, like, you can kind of seduce people into hope gently. You know, you can gradually, by planting a little seed in the future, which they didn't have, and seeing that comes to fruition in even the very smallest way, there's then the idea that maybe you plant another seed and another one, then you know, you never know what can happen. Gradually, a possible future emerges out of a nothing. And tell me how you see teaching this kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. I mean, I think it's definitely progressive. I think it needs to be. I think it needs to be a stepwise process, and I think there's lots of, you know, there's quite a strong psycho-oncology contingent in Canada who do a lot of work around this. And there's very, you know, some of the mechanisms, goal setting, I think, is one of the ones that we use an awful lot. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that's going to become more and more important as the years and as the research goes by. And I think, and I guess particularly when it's applied to patients who are, you know, later stage and are, you know, clinically classified as incurable, you know, if someone tells you you've got 12 months to live or 6 months to live statistically, I think that the most important thing that, actually above all else at that point, is planning things for 2 years away and 3 years away and making that goal, you know, so clear and so powerful and so meaningful that, you know, and we do think it's not a bucket list. I hate that term. Mm-hmm. It's not about getting things done in time. It's about someone saying to you, well, you've got a statistically shortened period of life, and you're saying, I respect your opinion, I respect the statistics, but I unequivocally refuse to accept that, and my reality is that I will be here in 10 years and I will be here fit and well. And I think goal setting has a huge role to play in that, because we know it has the capacity to change emotional states, we know it has the capacity to change biochemical states, because when we're moving towards something, when we have this goal, when we're saying, okay, in 2 years' time, I'm going to be, you know, walking all of the lakeside paths in the Lake District, which is a real life example of someone we worked with a few years ago.
Okay.
You know, it's not just having that dream and mind in your kind of thought process, it's actually initiating behaviors that allow that to reach fruition. So booking the accommodation, you know, increasing your walking fitness and capacity, buying your backpack and walking boots, and setting a longitudinal path from where you are now to that goal, and setting that out in a timeline, in a vision board is great. You know, putting getting a big board with loads of pictures on the Lake District, where you're going to do, and looking at that every day, imagining that, visualizing that, and there's very clear research to show how visualization of goals changes your key variables within the body. So I think goal setting is a really powerful one. I think meditation and the meditative tools are very, very good at empowering hope, because it allows us to detach from the reality we find ourselves in, which is helpful as well. There's a lot of work around the neuroplasticity and how changing our thoughts changes the structure of our brain, and how if our thoughts are consumed with hopelessness and helplessness, the neural networks that are responsible for those emotions become more dominant. So they're the habitual responses, whereas if we start to initially almost force the brain off and away from hopelessness into hope, we know that the brain, you know, the brain starts to form new neural networks. And the more we use those, the stronger they become, until they become the habitual response and the default setting. And again, there's lots of work looking at how you can use different tools to mobilize that that neural network. Things like matrix remapping, NLP, EFT, all those kind of things. So there's lots of tools. That's just the tip of the iceberg. But you know, there's lots of tools that can be used to program hope and make hope a default setting. So it can definitely be done. I think, you know, people are blessed with different capacities. Some people are good at football. Some people are good at music. Some people are naturally predisposed to optimism and hope.
Right.
And some people aren't. But even those who aren't can still be taught it. They can still cultivate it enough to mobilize these benefits. That's the big thing. It's not, you know, it's not a select few. It can be, it should be for everyone.
Mm. Okay, well, I can see a great workshop ahead led by you for Yes to Life. I hope you might be up for that.
Definitely. Yeah, no, for sure.
Well, look, it's really interesting. I mean, what's emerging more and more with research is how the biggest factors affecting longevity, for example, aren't, you know, whether you smoke or not, whether your diet's rubbish or whatever. They're things like your, so, I mean, those are, of course, those matter. but nothing like as much as your social connections, your deep personal connections. And as you've indicated, this Japanese concept of having something to get up in the morning for, these kind of things actually have a lot more to do with how long we live and how well we live.
Yeah, and that's what I think is why it's so profound in the, you know, in the cancer survivorship model. Because if you look at all the case study reports, I think it's the Smithsonian Institute in America, they've got, you know, you can look at it online, they've got thousands and thousands of documented studies of exceptional survival and spontaneous remission and regression and whatnot. And what's interesting is that a lot of them, they haven't radicalized their diet, they haven't taken herbal medicines, they haven't studied meditation. What's facilitated it is that fundamental shift in, you know, why do I want to stay alive? What makes me feel vital? Why do I want to do this? And I think, you know, one of the great case studies was a farmer's wife who was in, I think she was in Montana. And she was diagnosed with, she'd put off going to, you know, to see her doctor for too long, and she was diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. They offered her treatment, but she said, and they said, obviously it comes with a lot of side effects, and we're not too sure about what the benefits are compared to the risks. And her transcript when she was interviewed, her first response to that was, I'm a farmer's wife, I've got 5 kids, I've got a farm to run, I can't be sick, this will have to wait. And she went away. And she wasn't in denial, but she refused to accept that she was ill. And it may not have been that, but you know, her health didn't decline, and she went back for periodic scans. And her tumor, it was still active, but it was regressing, and it was contained. And you know, the researchers got hold of her and, you know, tried to understand what she was doing, and she didn't do anything. Her diet wasn't particularly good. She was a little bit overweight, but she had such motivation to be well and to live Karen's life because she couldn't do anything else, that I'm absolutely convinced that kind of mindset, you know, mobilizes something in the body, something in the brain probably, that results in this cascade response within the body that changes us so profoundly that it allows, yeah, the pharmacy and natural anti-cancer mechanisms to become so mobilized that they, at the very least, can contain progression. They may not be able to reverse it. And I'm not saying that's universally true for everyone all of the time, but I think if one person can do it, it shows that the mechanism is there. And I think what the best model would be to not exclude anything, having the very best of conventional medicine, the diet and the meditation, all of the complementary medicine, but not ignoring that mindset. Because I think if you take that out and you do radicalize your diet and you do start exercising, you meditate, and you're having all the conventional treatment, if you're terrified and helpless and hopeless and you don't know why you want to stay alive, I don't think those variables will have anywhere near as much impact as they could have. So I think it's everything. It's that synergy of the whole being greater than the sum of the parts. But I think if you take away that mindset, you take away a lot. So I think it's so important. It's subtle. It's those subtleties rather than the very obvious measurable qualities. I think it's so key.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's certainly at the top of my list of the most important things. You know, the mindset's the first thing, the mind and spirit. And then, you know, you move on to things like the diet next. But it's the foundation. Yeah, so very interesting.
It definitely is.
Yeah, Kelly Turner's book, Radical Remission, has done a great deal to sort of bring the whole cause of exceptional survivorship and what it's all about to the fore. Great book. The thing that was very striking...
Fantastic book, yeah.
Yeah, the thing that was really striking to me there, out of it, I think it's got 9 things that people, or you know, all the people she looked at did, and 7 of those are to do with the mind and spirit. 7 out of 9.
Yeah.
2 of them are sort of, you know, take herbs and supplements and things like that. But, you know, 7 of them are these things to do with attitude and taking control of your life, all that kind of stuff. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, and that's a big percentage, isn't it? 7 out of 9.
It is.
I mean, I think that book is, you know, you should be compulsory reading for anyone. You know, the moment of diagnosis, I think they should be given that. And I think the beauty of it is that it breaks it down in such an easy, you know, it's a very bite-sized kind of book, is that you can pick up something and run with it and apply it and then do that. But I think it is, and I think even, you know, it polarizes people, I suppose, to a degree, but you know, the mindset and the kind of the psychological and emotional side people are willing to subscribe to, but you know, the more spiritual dare I say it, you know, religious side to it is difficult because, it's a bit like Marmite. I think people either love it or they hate it.
Right.
You know, you're either spiritually orientated or you're not. But there is quite clear, like in the Radical Remission book and other pieces of research, there is quite clear research that people who have some, it hasn't got to be called religion, but people who have some belief and in something bigger than themselves, whether it's God or nature or spirit or energy or consciousness, whatever you want to call it, but people who subscribe to the fact that it's not this isn't everything, and when we die, there's nothing more. There's people who believe in a bigger picture and cultivate that kind of mindset. Generally have less negative emotions like fear, anxiety, uncertainty, etc. And I think that's quite challenging because it's very hard to mobilize those kinds of benefits in people if they're very resistant to them. And I think that, but you know, from the Radical Remission, you know, anyone who's read that will see how you know, potentially important those kinds of mechanisms are. But I think that is tricky because it opens a can of worms.
can do, yeah.
Yeah.
The other people I'd really like to read the book, of course, would be some oncologists. Would be great. The story of oncology so far is that up until about 1960 something or even later, the routine was you just told a lie, barefaced lie, and never used the word cancer, and that was seen to be the best thing for patients. And then since then they've moved sort of, you know, from black to white, from one end of the spectrum to the other. They now have things that are presented as facts. And, you know, blandly, yeah. You know, yes, you have a prognosis of blah, 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 whatever it is. And of course, well, that's a fairy tale too, you know, because they're not facts, as you've just been talking, you know, they're true for some people. But for some people, they don't apply at all. So neither of those is very useful to people. What the first one doesn't really mobilize the piece that's, you know, the thing about being presented with the picture of the fact that they're very ill, there's nothing wrong with that necessarily, because it can mobilize somebody to realize, oh my God, I've left things too much. You know, actually, this is the point at which I need to mobilize all my energies to survive for this reason or for that reason, you know, that, and that's a good thing. So they denied that by being given a fairy tale. But almost worse, they're crushed by being given some facts that they've got 9 months to live, you know, as well.
Yeah.
It's almost more difficult for the body, I think, to cope with that.
Yeah.
And both these mechanisms, to me, have been evolved for the sake of oncologists. They're to prevent oncologists from becoming emotionally involved with a patient who's ill. You know, they keep the whole thing at distance, and they're not for the patient's benefit at all. And the middle path of presenting the difficulties without saying it all up and saying, well, we, you know, this is the things we know. We don't know what's going to happen with you, and we're all going to work together to do our best to get you through this. That would be it, wouldn't it? That would be really supportive.
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely everything. Because I think at that point, I think, you know, within the first 72 hours of those bombshells, you know, going off around someone, whether it's initial diagnosis or perhaps even more so if it's, you know, reoccurrence, or, you know, the prognosis is a lot more advanced than, you know, was originally thought. You know, that 72 hours from that point often lays the foundation of what happens over the coming months. And I think the way exactly what you said, I think it's so important, the way the news is delivered, you know, will have such a huge effect upon the way that person's body and mind works over the coming weeks and months. And, you know, we ran I'm going to be very vague with details and locations here, because, you know, but we ran, you know, a clinical trial in a very sick group of cancer patients, and looking at the way news was delivered from different clinical care teams. And what was really interesting is, you know, these were women who had recurrence after initial diagnosis. Yeah, and if the Macmillan nurse or someone in the clinical care team comes in and they sit down and say, you know, it's not the best news in the world. It has progressed, and it's reoccurred, it's progressed a little bit, but, you know, there's lots of things, there's lots of new trials coming out, there's things that we can do, there's things that you can do. Let's get a really strong integrated plan going here, and let's get on top of this. the patient gets the news, but they feel, right, okay, they're confident, I should be confident, let's really get on top of this and just, you know, make this treatment plan so robust that we can contain this. Whereas if someone comes in and, you know, keeps their hand on the door handle, doesn't really engage with the patient, and says, scans have come back, the cancer's progressed, and, you know, and it's going to be tricky to manage this now, and then walks out again, then that patient is left in such a state of overwhelm and uncertainty that what do they do then? And they shut down, and it's the same scan, it's the same news, but the way that's delivered, I think is a really big area that's not been. There's been a few studies. Southampton was involved in a study looking at that, but I think it's something that should really be taught to people delivering that kind of news. That yes, it has to. You have to give them, you know, a degree of unbiased information, but it can be presented in such an empowered and hopeful way. And it's like, it's rare. Like, anyone who's worked around cancer and oncology, you know, it's quite rare to be on the receiving end of positive news delivery, isn't it? Even when it's bad news, it's usually, like you say, negatively delivered and hopeless as such. And I think that, I think that's a huge amount of work that can be done in training people to empower people even when the news is bad. I think that's such an untapped area within cancer research. I think the potential is massive for that.
Right with you. Unfortunately, we're sort of beleaguered with this concept of false hope. That's the one that gets bandied around, which, of course, is ridiculous. There's either hope or there's no hope. There's no such thing as false hope. Hope is life, effectively. If you don't have any hope, you don't have any future, you don't have a life. So it's a fundamental to human existence. And if you take it away from people, you are killing them, basically. And it's not your right to do such a thing, because anybody, however ill they are, can have some sort of reasonable hope that they might get through it, because they might.
And there's always, you know, there's so much, you know, every year going by, there's more and more research to show that that's achievable, that, you know, there are other people with your cancer at your stage and your age and your gender who have gone on to achieve that. If one person's done it, we know it can be achieved. So rather than setting our goal on, you know, okay, let's get a good 12 months, you know, let's make the next 12 months really good and go out with a bang. So now they're doing what we can to make sure that in 5 years we're still having a great life. And then look at the next 5 years. And like you say, this concept of false hope, it drives me to distraction. It's such a ridiculous idea. Like you say, if you're alive, there's always hope. There's always, always hope, you know, irrespective of statistics and what you've been told. And I think statistics, they have a place, don't they? But, you know, I have quite big problems with statistics, because they're historical. They have no relevance to you or I or, you know, our family or anyone who's diagnosed with cancer, because they've never been researched before. They've never been there before. So how can anyone say that that's what's going to apply to you? It might apply to the, you know, the mean in that situation, but that's completely irrelevant to that person. It's like looking at a football club, looking at their past 80 matches against any given team and saying, statistically, you're going to lose this coming Saturday.
Right.
You know, his history bears no relevance, does it, to what's happening now? And I think, I think statistics, I mean, I see why they're useful, in terms of telling people about how,
statistics, anybody who's not in total fear and all the rest of it, they're in a place where they can make good decisions. Statistics is useful information. It's not a death sentence or anything else, but it gives you probabilities and it helps guide you towards some decisions and not others. It's great stuff, you know. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's not the future, you know. It's just not.
No, definitely not the future.
Yeah, right.
And also, the other thing with statistics is, you know, they're so heavily skewed. If you look at the, you know, the normality curves for cancer, you know, cancer survival in any given situation, if you think about what informs that average point of death for that cohort, they're so heavily skewed. The average survival statistic is so heavily skewed by people who are overweight, who've got other morbidities, who are lonely, who are drug users, who are smokers, you know, all those things that drastically skew that statistic. If you look at the people who move to the right-hand side of that statistic on the graph, they're the ones that have great family support and they have love in their life and they've got that ikigai, a reason to live, they're motivated, they modify their diet, you know, they're seeking other opinions, and they are moving mountains to stay healthy and well. So it's not an accurate means aren't an accurate overview of what we can achieve, are they? So I think it's really important that's put across to people that, okay, the scans have come back and now statistically you've got somewhere between 6 and 12 months. But there's plenty of people who move significantly beyond that, and let's make sure you're one of those by doing
right.
X, Y, and Z.
Now you're talking.
So, yeah. So I think they definitely have a role, but as long as they're put in context,
yes.
I think that's the biggest thing, is they have to be contextualised when they're delivered.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah, and the other concept that goes hand in hand with the certainty of the statistics, the idea of false hope, is the concept of terminal, of course, and that is, again, a sort of future prediction which is put on people, which says, we know you're going to die, which, you know, they don't. It's not true. It's a fairy tale. All they can say is there's quite a probability you're going to die quite soon, given your circumstances.
Yeah.
But to actually, you move from a place where you're alive to your terminal, there's a sort of, you know, an in-between realm, a sort of bar there, where you're certain you're going to die. It's shocking. I think it's just, I hear people talking on the radio who've been told this and they've taken it on board and they're saying, yeah, well, I know I'm terminal. And I'm like, what? You know, I would never accept that personally. And we don't accept it for people who are part of charity. If you're still alive, well, you're alive. You're not terminal. And you're terminal when you've actually started the process of dying. You know, there is a piece right at the end, isn't there, where you're actually dying and you're terminal. And I think that's fair enough. But up until then, you're still alive, so there's still hope. You don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I think that probably summarises almost all the points you talk about, you know, that hope and empowerment we talked about at the start, you know, all the way through to, you know, this idea of, you know, statistics and everything else. And again, there's some really quite controversial, you know, looking at voodoo curses, there's some pretty profound... Yeah, and back then, you know, it was the witch doctor with their rattles and leopard skins and ash-covered faces, that because that person was respected, they said, you're going to die on the next full moon. And that belief is, that fear is so, you know, all-consuming in the person who's been told that, that there's a mechanism to show that's enough to actually shut down organ function. Fast forward that 100 years, it's someone in a white coat and a stethoscope who's respected and who has, you know, who has that... that capacity to induce belief through, you know, in a good way or a bad way, and that person looking someone in the eyes and saying, "Yeah, you're terminal now," it's a modern day clinical voodoo curse, because it creates optimal emotional and psychological and biochemical and immunological responses that can maximise the chance of that person dying sooner, I think, because they're told they're going to die. So when someone that they believe knows that, but they're not, you know, we're not, no one is fortune teller. No one can know what's going to happen. Like you say, it's a statistic. But, you know, every day, if we're alive, there's hope that we'll be alive tomorrow and the next day. And that's all anyone can say, whether we've got cancer, whether we're 2 years old, 102, all we've got is now, isn't it? And no one can tell us what's going to happen in 6 months or 12 months. And I agree that there's always got to be hope. And like you say, when you get to that point where it becomes very palliative and hospice care is involved, then there probably is a good chance that maybe you're going to die quite soon. But until that point is initiated, I think it's unacceptable for anyone to tell you you're going to be dead in X amount of months. I think that needs to change. And it needs to change quickly.
Yeah. Okay, well, look, you're very passionate about this, and I'm right with you on everything you said. Brilliant. We've done the show completely back to front. You haven't told our listeners anything about you at all, but that you have, of course, by what you've been speaking about. But nonetheless, we're at least two-thirds of the way through the show, but let's go back to the beginning now and just ask you a little bit about your background.
Yep.
You've been in cancer research. Tell us about that.
Yep. Yeah, so working in cancer research, looking at, well, quite a few different areas, but I guess the same thing, my driving force has always been the more of the subtlety around what allows exceptional cancer patients to become exceptional. I used to work under Professor George Lewis, who I think used to be a patron of, was involved with Yes to Life, maybe?
Yes.
So, you know, anyone knows George will know how... maverick and motivating and exceptional he was.
Yes.
And he installed in me this belief that, you know, it's the non-specific effects of healthcare that allow people to achieve, you know, amazing responses to anything, whether it's you know, IBS and migraine all the way through to cancers and heart diseases. So so the research we worked on was trying to tease that apart and looking at things like, you know, the complex interventions around meditation and diet, you know, herbal medicines, a whole range of approaches that can be applied to primarily to the cancer arena, and then looking at how, you know, initially how that affected quality of life, but then looking at how it affected biochemistry and cancer markers and immune markers and longevity, particularly in terminal groups. And that still is my kind of main passion. And then we use that information to design something called the Cancer Survivorship Program, which is an 8-week group-based, so 10 to 15 patients in a group-based setting, which goes through on a module-by-module basis looking at the key components. So this was before radical remission, but actually it was very similar, mm-hmm. Looking at the key kind of mechanisms and approaches that cancer patients should be trying to integrate into daily life. And then I also trained, qualified in Ayurvedic medicine, which is, I don't know where to begin talking about Ayurvedic medicine because it's such a broad area, but it's a complementary system of medicine. It's very similar to Chinese medicine. It originates in Asia, in India, and it's looking at, I mean, the overarching premise of Ayurvedic medicine is that if we can get the body into optimal balance, so irrespective of the health complaint that we're facing, if we can get optimal balance in the body, if we can get the body in homeostasis, then the body can self-manage and self-regulate virtually any condition. It's that very, very hope motivated. And it looks at uses, you know, herbal medicines and prescriptions and meditation and yoga and diet and all kinds of things to achieve that. But it's just, it always strikes me as interesting or ironic, I suppose, in a way that if you look at everything we've been talking about, and if you look at radical remission and all these kinds of books, if you had to summarize it all and say what is that actually achieving, then I think for me that the single biggest thing that it achieves is it moves the body into homeostasis. It moves the body, you know, all 50 trillion cells in their entirety. It moves us into balance. And when we're in balance, we know that we work and we think and we act more efficiently. So the Ayurvedic and Chinese medicine is very much moving into the Western framework, because I think it has, you know, time-tested tools that allow people to achieve that. And at my old department in Southampton, you know, lots of the research was looking at Chinese and herbal medicines and meditation and those kinds of approaches. So I think the West is looking east in some respects to kind of empower and solve the issue of how, you know, how do we manage this public health time bomb that's going on at the moment, because, you know, you can't be fixed with drugs and surgery. It needs an integrative approach. And I think, you know, these kinds of entirely inclusive, very holistic and very safe forms of medicine have a, you know, very profound role to play in that. And I think, you know, it's the way it's going to go actually over time. So that's kind of where I come from. And we're still now looking to take new research projects forward, looking at exactly what we talked about and trying to tease apart what we spoke about at the start, is the subtleties of hope and mindset and news delivery and how people deal with statistics and how can you empower people with tools to help them become more hopeful and empowered and live with ikigai, so they live with purpose. And because it's so hard to actually delineate those, you can obviously quantify how many portions of vegetables and how many vitamins, right, and how much green tea someone is having a day, how much exercise they're doing. You can quantify all of that, but it's very hard to objectively quantify those kinds of subtle traits, but there must be ways of doing it, and that's something that I'm really keen to try and do. Because I think if we can create a framework around that, then we can give it to people, and if we can give it to people, then we can try and mobilise it in as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a man who's been engaged in this area for decades now, Dr. Robin Youngson, who's been on my show. Fantastic. Doctor from New Zealand, you've come across him?
Yes.
He's the man. I mean, work he's done is fantastic. And of course, he manages to combine, incredible humanity with good science. So he has found ways to pull together statistics that back up. Unfortunately, we're in an age where you have to have statistics to prove that common sense is common sense. You know, that you do normal human responses actually are the best thing, you know. And but you have to be able to back that up scientifically, unfortunately. But be that as it may, he's been doing it and he's done an incredible job. And he's more on fire now than he ever was about changing the mode of operation of healthcare so it actually has some caring in it.
Yeah.
You know, not just
drugs empathy. And...
empathy, exactly. So a fantastic guy.
Yeah.
But can we just go back? You were talking about, I mean, obviously you've been in a kind of medical environment which has been more open-minded than most. And
Very open-minded.
Yeah, which is very interesting. And you've wholeheartedly embraced Ayurveda, which is obviously one of the things you set a lot of store by. And it's a totally different form of medicine, really, isn't it? It's like chalk and cheese in many ways to Western medicine. The whole thinking behind it, the mindset behind it, is so different. This has been one of the biggest barriers in a way to the meeting of these two. But you in yourself have kind of made enough room to accommodate both and have respect for both as well, which is not an either or, that one's rubbish, this one's proper. You know, that kind of black and white thinking. You've actually, able to say this and this, which of course is the very foundation of integration. It's a bigger concept. It's a bigger way of looking at things that allows you to bring all the resources in that will bring the best results. So can you say a little bit about, you know, what this ability to encompass different ways of seeing and thinking?
I think it's everything, because I think, you know, Western medicine has got flaws, Ayurvedic medicine has got flaws, you know, every system of medicine has strengths and weaknesses. And I think to put your flag in the sand in one camp and say, well, I'm going to exclusively use this approach at the expense of any others, I think it's absolute madness. It flies in the face of common sense. It flies in the face of evidence. So I think integrated medicine, not just in the cancer arena, but in, you know, general healthcare, in primary care and secondary care, yeah, I think integrated medicine is the only way forward. I think, you know, with the global health population predicted to hit 10 billion by 2050, people living longer, we're going to be living, you know, people will be having more years with chronic disease. And I think, you know, complementary medicine can't manage that on its own. Western medicine can't manage that on its own, but integrated medicine can. And I think you know, I think the problem at the moment is it's the educated, more affluent people who seek out, you know, the integrative approaches, the herbal medicines and Ayurveda and Chinese medicine, but it needs to be accessible and exposed to everyone, whether you're an unemployed single mom from a council estate or whether you're a billionaire in London. It needs to be available. And I think everyone needs to, I think people need to knock down the walls that people have built around their own area of expertise and open up and talks need to be initiated about getting, you know, what does the science show? I think I agree with you about the evidence-based culture. It's gone so far now that you can't, you know, unless there's evidence and statistics, you can't make these claims. And I think there's a good side to that, but also I think it's probably more damaging in the long term, because common sense, you know, does prevail as well. And I think what we need is a model where people are getting the very best of conventional medicine. They're having the best that's available, new trials, new immunotherapy, the new chemotherapeutic, whatever it may be. But to just have that, I think, is absolute madness. Mm. You know, we know that herbal medicines can support the body during chemotherapy. There's research to show, clear research to show how certain herbs reduce chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting, fatigue, post-chemotherapy infections, preventing neutropenia. We know there's clear research, but you know, everyone needs to come to the same table with an open mind and say, you know, my approach isn't best, you know, your approach isn't best, but we've all got things to offer. Let's sit down, not about our egos or about, you know, what can we can achieve or about money, but what, you know, the next patient we see, what can we give them that's going to really help? What's going to give them the best, you know, health physically, emotionally, psychologically, that's going to allow them to dominate this situation? And I think,
right,
you know, there are centres in the UK that are doing that. I mean, Southampton's probably leading it in terms of the integrated medicine, and that's good because the research is coming out. But I can't see any other way forward for chronic disease management, particularly cancer,
right,
unless it's integrated. I think it's the only way. I just think it's so important. I just think it's happening too slowly, which is what worries me. It needs to be happening more quickly.
Right.
It can be done.
Yeah, the future of cancer care. You're absolutely right. I agree with you there. It's interesting with that, this sort of broadening, if you like, of what medicine looks like, that quite a few of the leading spokespeople come from another culture, the ones in this country. They're quite often, you know, you're obviously a big supporter of Ayurveda. Well, quite a lot of Indian heritage doctors are the leading spokespeople in this country towards broadening the concept of what treatment looks like, which is, I think, is a great thing, because it's, they obviously come from a culture that deeply accepts a lot of things that are just like, well, they're not taken for granted over here at all, you know, in terms of medicine. So
yeah,
it really is having a profound effect. And I think the public that are hearing these messages is saying, ah, at last, yes, please. You know, it's they're hungry for it.
Yeah. Definitely. And also, I think there's some, you know, real heavyweights. You know, Prince Charles is like, you know, and I know he's come under some controversy around different things, but, you know, he's obviously so heavily for integrated medicine and so heavily involved. And obviously there was the parliamentary debate, or, you know, a few weeks ago, last month, about integrating Ayurvedic medicine into secondary care. And there's a similar prospect in place with Chinese medicine, and France now has got Chinese medical centres that are running alongside Western hospitals. So
right,
I think, you know, the wheels are definitely turning. And I think, you know, behind closed doors, I think a lot of people in the decision-making roles are very aware of that. It's probably just a case of how is it put across in a way that's not going to scare people off or upset the apple carts.
Right.
But yeah, it is the way forward. And it is interesting that it's people often from, you know, cultures where this is just inherent belief system who are the leading voices in this. But that's good. Like you say, it's a fantastic thing.
Mm. Another thing that's quite striking is how, as there is the beginnings of some serious research into other approaches, things are being taken seriously that have been poo-pooed for years. I'm increasingly bumping into situations. And, you know, in last week's show, I was talking to a doctor from the University of Iowa, and they've just done these trials which have shown that they can double the survival of some of the worst cancers by just adding vitamin C. You know, now vitamin C's been around 50, 60 years as a cancer treatment, and not taken seriously,
yeah,
of course. And that piece of research could have happened any time, but, you know, it's taken until now before somebody's had the resource and the guts to do it, really.
Yeah.
You know, it increasingly seems to me I come across these situations where one single unorthodox thing like vitamin C is added into completely bog standard conventional care, and it has an incredible all-round effect. There's less damage to the patient, they have less side effects, and they tolerate the treatment much better, and the treatment works much better, and they live longer. You know, all those things,
yeah,
happen because one substance was introduced to sort of, you know, balance,
yeah,
out the extraordinarily one-sided approach of just using toxins. This
yeah,
applies quite often. And, you know, this is the sort of barest minimum of integration, if you like. But it can have an extraordinary effect. I mean, twice the lifespan is like, this is major.
Yeah. And how is that? I mean, exactly. What's frustrating is, like I said, it's been around for so long, and that has been cynical head on, where that had been a synthetic drug,
yes,
yeah, that probably would have been far more headlined. But because it falls under that banner of being a little bit off-centre, it doesn't necessarily get the publicity, does it? But you wonder how many, if you added in the vitamin C, and then you added in, you know, some clinically proven herbal immunomodulators,
yes,
and herbs that we know induce cell death in cancer, apoptosis in cells, in cancer cells, and we get people on, you know, high dose antioxidant diets and whatever it may be. Imagine if we, rather than looking at, you know, it's obviously fantastic, phenomenal that vitamin C has done that, but then if we add other things around that, the gains could, you know, should be exponential. And
that's
such an exciting concept.
You're right.
Yeah, exciting time.
I hope the doors are just beginning to open. I mean, you know, Britain's one of the most resistant countries in the West to change in this area, I think. I think I call us backward Britain. But nonetheless, it is beginning to happen, you know, and the mechanisms to make it possible, to make a degree of choice possible for people who've got cancer are just beginning to come into place through, you know, social prescribing and personal health budgets. So I hope that, give us another 5 years' time, that, you know, choosing to have vitamin C will be no big deal.
Yeah, rather than being wacky.
Yeah.
Look,
this has been a fascinating talk. Nothing like the one I had planned. Really good, though. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. Your passion for all this is just, you know, completely comes through, and very exciting. You're based down on the south coast there. Do you want to just quickly say where your practice is, what you're doing generally, a very quick summary of what you offer?
Yeah, so we run a health company down in the South Coast in Chichester. So we run health courses, we run workshops, we have our clinic here, we have a bit of a wellness hub. So we just do lots of different things. It's like what we talked about, it's all about empowering people. It's about saying, how can you take care of your own health using an integrated model that has evidence to support it? And that's pretty much everything. That's what drives us, it's what informs how we work. So just to try and get a bit of a paradigm change on the way that, when someone gets a cold or gets, you know, something wrong with them, they think the first response is, how can I take care of this myself? And that's hopefully something that we can advance as we go down the line. So, yeah. But thank you so much for inviting me on to talk to you. I'm very grateful. And, yeah, it's been really good. So thank you.
That's a pleasure. Do make a point of watching some of Dr. Watts's Facebook videos, like the one that fired me up before the interview. Search for Mind-Body Medical, that's Mind Body Medical, on Facebook. And if you're not already linked up to Yes to Life's Facebook, or to mine for that matter, while you're there, search and like Yes to Life Charity, as well as robindaily.yestolife. So that's Yes to Life Charity and robindaily.yestolife. And I'd like to tell you about an important Yes to Life event coming up in spring. It's on Saturday, the 27th of April, from 11 till 3, and it's in Manchester, at the Manchester Art Gallery in Mosley Street. It's a cancer wellness day with themes around nutrition, exercise and emotional well-being. For more information and booking, look on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and click events in the left-hand sidebar. I hope you enjoyed listening to Sam Watts as much as I did, and you'll want to join me again next week for another Yes to Life show. Goodbye.